Hello and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Jackie Canterbury. Today we are joined by a man who has spent much of his life learning directly from the wind, the water, and wilderness. Kurt Holting is a wilderness guide, commercial fisherman, Zen practitioner, and founder of the Inside Passage Sea Kayaking Program in Alaska. For decades, he has led people into some of the most remote and powerful landscapes on the planet, Alaska, often to a path of awakening. In his new book, Apprentice to the Wild, Holting reflects on a lifetime of encounters with both the outer wilderness of the natural world and what he calls the inner wild, that untamed, often overlooked dimension within ourselves. Blending memoir, nature writing, and spiritual insight, the book explores risk, loss, aging, mentorship, and what it means to become an elder in these uncertain times. And, you know, at a moment when many of us are feeling increasingly disconnected, maybe from our country, from nature, from community, even from ourselves, this work asks a timely question. What might the wild still have to offer and teach us? So, Kurt, welcome to Nature Now. It's really nice to see you today. I loved your book in so many ways, and what you blended together in your storytelling was so compelling for me. So let's talk about it, and let's talk about your life.
Great. Thanks, Jackie.
You're very welcome. So nice to see you. I think the listeners would really appreciate first knowing the story behind the creation of this book.
Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, I have a previous book, The Circumference of Home, from 2010, and that was different. And what I wanted to do here after almost 50 years of working as a commercial fisherman and wilderness guide in Alaska was to leave some stories for my grandchildren. So it really started out, the motivation was a letter to my grandchildren. When I was young, I had a grandfather on my father's side who homesteaded in Montana at the kind of turn of the 20th century, the end of the homesteading era. Kind of rough-hewn man, grew up on a farm in the Midwest, and turned out that he was a really good storyteller. So when we were kids, we would sit around the fire, and he would tell his stories from homesteading in Montana, and we just couldn't get enough.
So that's where you got it.
That's where I, yeah.
It's from your grandfather.
Yeah, from a grandfather. Realizing how much those stories still live in me and how much impact they had on me, in terms of creating a yearning to experience some of the solitude and wildness that we heard him talking about. So I wanted to just collect some of my published essays, a few of them, and some unpublished essays, and write some new ones. My friend, the poet Holly Hughes,
yes,
who lives in Chimicum and with her husband, John Pierce, runs Empty Bowl Press. Holly's been a longtime friend of mine. She was a commercial fisher in Alaska also. She's worked with me as an editor in the past. So she actually offered to look at what I had put together as a manuscript and came back and said, we would really like to publish this if you would expand the scope a bit. So including some of the essays about my more recent life outside of Alaska. And that ended up being a section in the book that I called Becoming an Elder. So that was a process for me of taking this project seriously, more and more seriously. And I remember hearing an interview with the novelist George Saunders, Sam Harris interview with him, at one point where he talked about when he writes, he always writes for beyond his own lifetime. And I just thought that was a really interesting insight. And when I looked through my manuscript, it was sort of like, you know, good enough, getting good enough, but was it that good? And so I really took on the manuscript.
Interesting. So you say that beyond a lifetime, and you mentioned that you know, kind of an ode to your grandchildren.
Yeah.
You wanted to document. And then you also mentioned that you have written papers.
I have a number of essays that have found their way into published collections of essays and that kind of thing from both especially commercial fishing and my work with Inside Passages, leading mindfulness-based sea kayak. You know, I lived in Petersburg year-round for a number of years, and really almost all of my summers from college on were in Alaska and usually based in Petersburg.
Okay.
And I do have a small off-grid lodge south end of the Wrangell Narrows, so outside of Petersburg, where the last 10 years of my guiding I based out of there.
Good.
So I still have that. And,
I guess you'd be sad. Yeah. St. Petersburg was always so beautiful and always known as the fishing place.
It's hardcore fishing. Yep.
Yeah, very much so.
Yep.
So, you know, your book really talks a lot about, and what drew me to it so much is the wildness. And I suppose you and I both have that love for wild places, which is, you know, not many people could go in their 20s and live up in Alaska out in the middle of nowhere. So what does it mean to be an apprentice to the wild?
Well, there's so many layers to it as well. And part of what's interesting to me about that question, having grown up in the Salish Sea, Puget Sound region, and having spent my summers in a beach cabin by Puget Sound near Paulsbow when I was young. And that's where I really sort of got infused with a love of the inland sea and the wildness of the inland sea, those summers. And then I literally stumbled into a chance to go salmon seining in the end of my freshman year in college at the University of Washington. But I grew up in this place with a very strong outdoor emphasis and pull toward the whole skiing and backpacking and climbing and all that.
So you grew up in this beautiful place. I did too. And you also had a grandfather then that taught stories.
Yes.
So then what this book does essentially is it melds your storytelling from your grandfather with this incredible place that we live in, which was very difficult when you and I grew up here.
Yes.
Very different.
Yes. It's been so interesting to me, and I think we might talk a little more about the evolution of my understanding of wildness. But having grown up in this area and with an orientation toward, you know, wilderness areas and getting out in various ways and then commercial fishing, I just developed quite young a passion for getting as far out on the wild edge as I could.
Sure.
And there's no wilder edge on the planet than the Northwest coast, basically from Puget Sound to Southeast Alaska. And it's vast and it is wild.
And you can get lost.
And yeah, you have to have a lot of skills to navigate and function in all these different environments, whether it's out on the ocean or whether it's climbing in the Cascades or the Coast Range. I naturally gravitated toward those experiences and those skills and chose a livelihood structure that got me out there.
It was around wildness.
Yeah, it was built on wildness. Yeah.
And you mentioned that your understanding of wilderness has changed over time.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's a really interesting question that I ponder a lot, because when I was young, and we're talking in the 60s and 70s, where the Wilderness Act had just been passed. So I was a wilderness warrior back in my younger years, really involved in the effort to establish and create wilderness areas, you know, federally mandated wilderness areas. And of course, the whole effort around the Alaska Lands Bill in 1980, I was real involved in that, where it went from 0 acres of wilderness in the Tongass National Forest to 6 million.
The Alaska Lands Act.
Yeah. So I was real involved in that. I was quite involved in some of that going on down here in the Pacific Northwest. And there was a sense that I had, that if we could just get these places protected, off limits to human development and all of that, that then we were good, you know?
Yes.
And of course, a big set of changes, maybe the biggest one over the last bunch of years, has been the climate crisis.
Yes.
And the ways in which all of these artificial lines drawn on the map around certain areas have no power whatsoever to stop climate impacts. So there's a big change.
Yes.
And that's its own kind of wildness, you know, generated by the wild human, you might say. The climate crisis grows out of our own wildness in a certain way.
So what you're saying then is your understanding of wilderness has changed over time, and one of the reasons is because the changes to the landscape.
The changes, changes to climate and ecologies that are massive.
Yes.
And as we're experiencing now, if something that can be federally mandated can be federally canceled.
Yes.
And we're up against that.
We're up against
now.
A lot right
and,
now.
You know, what we thought of as really firm protections, as a sense of the wilderness or the wild being somewhere out there where people don't go,
mm-hmm.
That's a big change because yes. I really see now every aspect of what's happening in the biosphere and what's happening in the human domain as manifestations of wild nature. It's not nearly as simple or as either or as I think young people often tend to think things are.
And your personal journey is really profound. When did you discover that wilderness could be your life's guide and teacher? Because it seems like that's what happened to you.
Yeah.
Is that it really changed? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. When I first got onto a commercial fishing boat, and I remember steaming north out of Petersburg, Frederick Sound and Chatham Strait the first time. And, you know, as a kid who grew up in Puget Sound and urban areas, and I could not believe how wild it was, that it could have been, you know, the early 1800s.
Right.
In terms of how
much. I understand that.
Yeah. So, and then growing up in Puget Sound, I wasn't in a family that liked to fish. So I never caught a salmon, but I was fascinated by salmon. And I had some, you know, little encounters with salmon that I felt from a very young age a kind of pull toward
salmon. And what kind of encounters did you have with salmon?
Well, there was one particular moment during, I think I was about 8 years old, during one of our summers, you know, on Liberty Bay, when there was this little dock where I would go to catch bullheads and, if I was really lucky, catch perch, sea perch. And one evening, when it was high tide and it was really calm, and I was out there and it was really quiet, and I looked up, you know, upshore and saw this huge form kind of emerge out of the murk and kind of pass underneath the dock and disappear. And it was obviously a salmon, my first, and I just went nuts. I just went nuts.
Yeah, understand.
So there's something in me, you know, I think of the Native American cultures of this region talk about being, you know, this is Salmon Nation. And,
yes.
And I think there was a way that I understood intrinsically or intuitively as a child even, once I saw salmon and saw people coming in with salmon from fishing, I wanted my life to be about
to be around salmon.
Salmon, yeah.
And, you know, salmon, if I can say salmon, are so wild as well. Mm-hmm. So absolutely beautiful and so wild. I mean, think about king salmon going out to the ocean and coming back to their native, you know, natal ground. They're pretty amazing. So talk to us now about your Zen practice. I find that interesting. So, you know, we've been talking about fishing. We've been talking about your storytelling. But now talk about how you got into the Zen practice and when and how it began and then the impact on your life.
Yeah. Well, I like to say that I am a recovering clergyman.
Yes.
So
talk about that a little, please.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
In college, in high school and college, I was involved in, pretty seriously involved in an evangelical Christian practice.
Okay.
Looking back on that, I see that as a kind of a time of spiritual awakening to there's another dimension. In college, I got interested in meditation. And when I moved to Alaska after college, or after divinity school, rather, I had this amazing opportunity to host the poet Gary Snyder in Petersburg.
Yes.
He was doing a tour of small villages in Alaska, and I heard about it, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, could you come to Petersburg? And figured no way, but he wrote back.
He
and
did.
He did. So he came in like 1984. And I had begun a sitting practice. I actually learned to do the Zen practice through a Trappist Roman Catholic contemplative community. So that was sort of the stepping stone from my Christian practice to Zen. And once I did my first Zen retreat, and Gary Snyder really mentored me in that after being with him in Alaska, he invited me to come do retreats at his small Zen community in the Sierra Nevada foothills, a place called Ring of Bones Zendo. So he was really my first Zen teacher. And then I went on what was called a Mountains and Rivers Zen retreat, something that Gary Snyder also brought into his work with being a leader of a Zen community, where we would go for a week-long wilderness backpack trip. And instead of doing a lot of sitting and a little walking, we would do a little sitting in the morning and evening, and then the whole day of backpacking and hiking in silence. was our practice.
In silence.
In silence. And then, you know, we had a teacher who was with us, a Zen teacher on the trip. And so we had the Zen rituals were worked into it. And I just loved it.
So that's how you melded wilderness with Zen practice. And you're saying that when you went out into the wilderness, that you were silent.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, silent except for cooking meals, breaking camp as needed. But then when I went back to Alaska that summer, I thought, well, why couldn't I do that with sea kayaking?
So that's what you did.
Yeah. So that's where it came from. Because when you're commercial fishing, the engine's always running. You're always working. You're always on task. And you're out in this incredible beauty, but you don't have time to really be with it. When we drop anchor at the end of the day, which is maybe 3 or 4 hours to sleep, but the engine would cut down and the silence would set in. I thought, I need more of this. So the combination of the two, of being in, you know, really wild area, the trips I led weren't totally in silence, but a lot of the time we were. And there's something about that. And I led the meditation and walking meditation and stuff in the morning. And then when we were paddling, we'd paddle in silence most of the time. And there's a way in which when you sort of agree to a culture of listening, rather than just gabbing the whole time, the power of the wild gets through, you know, it finds its way especially over a period of a week's time, in a way that can be really, really transformative.
And so what you're saying then is the healing potential of wilderness and wild places.
Yeah.
And if you're quiet and if you go out into places that are absolutely breathtakingly beautiful, it can transform people's lives. Because I remember talking to you about what happens when you, because then you started this project, business, if you will, of taking people out. And you'd take them out, and they would experience this beauty in quiet contemplation.
Right. And then we'd talk about it around the campfire at the end of the day. What did you notice today? You know, what was that like when the humpback whale surfaced 20 feet
what
from
did you
your
feel
kayak?
Like?
You know, what? Or orcas or the salmon. I mean, where I led my trips for many years was one of the richest salmon places in Southeast Alaska, Tebenkoff Bay Wilderness.
Oh, yes.
And like literally millions of salmon of all different species would come in. I think maybe not Chinook, but all the other species. Mm-hmm. So there would be salmon jumping by our campsites and, you know, at just all the time. You could hear the sound of their splash pretty much 24/7. And then the whales breathing, the breathing of the whales, that sometimes they'd come like right along the kelp beds by our campsite, or we would be sitting in meditation and the whales would breathe 50 feet from us. There's a way in which if you let that in and don't just go to evaluating it or talking about it, just let it in, it gets in. So that was the sort of, you know, that was what was obviously unique
about your experience.
And so people knew, I mean, that's what they were signing up for. So, you know, this was an agreement we would make that we were going to hold silence at certain times and we were going to speak about our experiences in a careful way. So, yeah.
And how many years did you have this business, Southeast Alaska?
About 26 years. So I did this for 26 years. When I first started it, I thought, am I crazy? What if is somebody going to die? Am I actually prepared? Can I actually do this? But it turned out that it worked really well. Is anybody going to come?
And they did. It became a very well-known business in Southeast.
So that turned out to be just sort of my dream job, that all the things that I love to do were sort of contained within it and included. There wasn't anything really left out. It was transformative for me. I mean, just being in wilderness like that is transformative,
yes,
no matter how you do it.
It is.
But then when you bring in an intention to sort of cultivate a listening heart, a listening practice, it just takes it down another level.
And it seems like your intention was rather pure, rather than wanting to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, your intention was a mix of your experiences in life and then giving it to other people, which is pretty profound. So let's explore. I'm really interested in some of the things that you talked about in terms of the inner wild. What is inner wild, and what has it meant to you throughout your life? You say in your book that we remain children of the wild. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And if it's okay, I want to read that little paragraph.
I would love it. Please.
In the introduction to my book, because that's an obvious question, what do I mean by being an apprentice to the wild? So I say this, to be born as a human being is to be thrust into the wild, cell, bone, psyche, and synapse, reclaiming a felt connection with the wild forces that gave birth to our species, recovering an active apprenticeship with the wild through which we swim, both inside and outside our mortal bodies, has become an essential part of our emerging survival equipment. No matter how domesticated our lives may feel, no matter how hard we may try to build a cocoon of comfort and convenience around ourselves, we remain children of the wild. We are wildness incarnate. That's a thumbnail sketch. But when I talk about the inner wild, what I'm really referring to is everything from the functioning, the 36 trillion cells in our body that are constantly doing their thing endlessly. And that is wildness incarnate on that level. The unconscious mind, the huge, vast domain of the unconscious that is beneath our conscious awareness, that's definitely wild mind. That goes all the way back. I mean, that's all the way back to the dinosaurs, is living inside of us. And then it manifests, you know, in thousands of different cultures and languages and customs. But all of those languages, customs are emerging wildness in a certain way. I mean, they're never domesticated, or they cannot be domesticated in any final way. And then any kind of spiritual practice that is designed to bring us into that territory, you know, that wild territory, yes, of heart, mind, and of spirit, and of the unknown, which is by far the biggest part of what makes us up, is not conscious or known. To tap into that in whatever ways we can is a practice of the wild. That's what Snyder called the practice of the wild.
Okay. Is tapping into that inner wildness.
Right. And then that also includes a practice of place, you know, intimacy with the places that we live, which is very much under siege now with,
yes,
of course, digital media that disembodies us not only from place but from our own heart mind
in
so many
really
ways.
That's really a good point. I think about that so much.
Yeah. But that is also a dimension of wildness. We don't know what's going to emerge out of this. It's completely
wild.
It's completely beyond what we can even imagine. It's scary in certain ways. In other ways, it's really alluring. We don't know what it's going to look like. Climate change, AI, you know, they're on the leading edge of, you know, the emerging wild, one could say.
They are. And, you know, you wrote candidly about grief,
yes,
and becoming an elder or becoming older, which is a challenge for all of us.
Yes.
It seems as though loss has really deepened your relationship with wildness through time.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes. I mean, you could say that loss is wildness also. I mean, whatever we have in this human life, we're going to lose.
Everything is going to evaporate.
And we spend a huge amount of energy avoiding that.
Yes.
The truth of that.
Yes.
One of the chapters that Holly wanted me to include, if they were going to publish,
yes,
it. I've lost two sons. I've had three children, and two sons and a daughter. One of my sons died as a toddler, and one died as a young man.
Sorry.
So I knew that, since for me, that has been my sort of most profound experience of,
yes,
loss, and every parent's worst fear, I knew I had to write about that. And so the opening chapter to what, you know, the section of the book, the final section, which I call Becoming an Elder, was my journey with grief in each of those losses. And I call that chapter Finding Refuge in the Country of Grief. And it was a powerful chapter for me to write about, for obvious reasons, but really how I chose, as I say in that chapter, when my first son died, I chose to turn my boat into the center of the rapids rather than heading for the hills. You know, like I'm going to go through.
So you confronted it.
I'm going to go into this. I'm going to go through it. I'm going to, you know, be rolled by it. I'm going to be all in. And, you know, that is a manifestation of how I, the Zen.
You
go with what is.
You go with the flow.
And you take what life delivers and work with it.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, those were excruciating times in my life and where I think I learned the very most. I'll just say that. So that was a powerful chapter. And really what comes out of it for me is that whatever our experiences of loss are, they are in many ways our greatest opportunity to become
fully human.
Mm-hmm. Because that is how it is to be human. And the energy that we expend pushing it away, avoiding it, trying to block it, the grief in this case, is energy not left over to live. To the degree that we allow that experience to change us, to deepen us, then that can become, the greatest gift of those losses is a loss of fear to fully live.
Thank you.
Yeah. And one other thing I'd say, it's also the greatest sort of bridge into common humanity. Like we're not alone. We think we're alone. We're not only not alone, but that is what all humans through all of time have, what binds us together as best we can, as best I could, to embrace it in that spirit.
And, if listeners could take one practice or perspective from your book into their own daily lives, what would you hope it would be?
I think the way I would say it is the practice of turning toward what is difficult rather than away from what is difficult and growing our capacity. And that's a lifelong practice. It's not like, and it's not an intellectual project. It is a full body, heart, mind, all. But to choose to be available to joy when it emerges all fully. But in order for that to happen, we can't be shutting ourselves off from pain. So to turn habitually and even ultimately maybe with gratitude toward what is most difficult about our lives and find ways to stay human in relation to it and find ways to at least know that it's not the whole story, but right now it's the whole story.
And this gives us a really good way in these difficult times, which I mentioned in the beginning.
Yes.
To actually be connected to one another and also to nature. And thank you, Kurt. This has been so wonderful. We could go on and talk. We'll have to do another episode.
Okay.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to everyone.